Hello, Helen. Pleasure to be with you. You are, just a matter of introduction, chair of the board of Women Political Leaders. You're the patron of the Helen Clark Foundation. You were the administrator of the United Nations Development Programme from 2009 to 2017, Prime Minister of New Zealand, 1999-2008. And I stop here with listing all your various achievements and accomplishments, because we want to use the time for a different kind of conversation than listing all your greatness and experience. If I start with a topic that is really dear to your heart, and just recently the global community celebrated for the second time the International Day of Multilateralism and Diplomacy for Peace. And for that day, on the occasion of that day, you and other global women political leaders contributed your insights in what are the threats that multilateralism faces today, and what should be done about it, but also how has COVID-19 made those threats even worse? If you could maybe give us a few ideas on this.
Multilateralism is not in its finest hour, shall we say. In fact, there's rather toxic geopolitics playing out at the moment, which make it quite difficult for key organs of the multilateral system, like the UN Security Council, to work. I have been part of a group of former women senior leaders in the international system, which has formed to support the system, and then specifically to raise issues as we see fit. And we did several weeks ago write to the president of the UN Security Council saying that we believe that the Security Council now should be following the precedent which was set with the Ebola epidemic in 2014. In that year, the Security Council passed a resolution, and remember, a Security Council resolution has the power of enforcement, member states must accept it. And it declared Ebola to be a threat to global peace and security, and then called on all member states to do whatever they can to avert that threat. We have had no such, even though clearly it is now presenting a far greater threat to global peace and security than Ebola did. Because COVID-19 has moved from being a health crisis to being a major economic and social crisis around the world. Now, in the last couple of weeks, there's been another attempt to get a resolution through the Security Council, falling well short of calling COVID-19 a threat to global peace and security. But France and Tunisia advanced a resolution which would have endorsed Secretary General Antonio Guterres's call for a global ceasefire. You know, all these warring parties out there, whether it's South Sudan, whether it's Yemen, whoever it is, please stop fighting and focus on addressing the pandemic. Now, the Security Council, of course, should endorse such a call by the Secretary General. The truth is that last Friday, that resolution failed, the 8th of May. And it failed because in it was what would normally be quite innocuous wording about supporting the relevant United Nations agencies working on COVID-19, including the specialised health agencies. And because one great power has, in effect, declared war on the WHO, the resolution failed. The terrible irony of it failing on the 8th of May was the 8th of May was the 40th anniversary marking the eradication of smallpox. And when you think about it, what an incredible thing it was that at the height of the Cold War, countries across the ideological and geopolitical divide came together to say, we will dedicate ourselves to eradicating smallpox. And they did it. And yet 40 years later, as we celebrated that anniversary, the Security Council failed to stand up for human security, health and well-being around our world. And that is very sobering. It is a major failure of the international system. And it's a failure that's also happening in the 75th anniversary year of the founding of the United Nations. And perhaps rather than that being something to celebrate right now, it's something which should cause us to take stock and say what could be done better.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned Ebola, and as the head of the UNDP, of course, you had a major leading role in the global response to the Ebola crisis at the time. And what would be the lessons that one should learn from the experience of Ebola to make things better this time? You mentioned a rather grim outlook just now, based on the positions of specific member states of Security Council. But what would be experiences on which one should build to have a better response this time?
Ideally, you should have global solidarity with the poorest countries, who always, in the end, bear a disproportionate burden of a global crisis. As I said, the crisis has the three dimensions. It has the health and well-being one. People are dying in very significant numbers in Europe and North America. And the epidemic has now reached every country in sub-Saharan Africa. Then, because countries are reacting in Africa, and frankly reacting a little earlier, I would suggest, than they did in the global north, there have been lockdowns. But if you are in a lockdown in a subsistence economy and your livelihood is gone and the government doesn't have the money for social protection, that's why you see people on our television screens saying, I'm going to die of hunger before I die of COVID-19. So it's causing very, very serious problems to livelihoods and to economies. Now, as of the last couple of days, 102 developing and emerging economies had applied to the International Monetary Fund for emergency support. This is absolutely extraordinary. And the IMF has the tools, it has the instruments, but it doesn't have the funding to meet the demand. So here's another area for attention in the international system. The G20 is clearly a powerful force. It represents 85% of the world's nominal GDP. Go back to 2009 and the global financial crisis. There was a rallying of the G20 leaders led by Prime Minister Gordon Brown of the United Kingdom for the $1 trillion package to stop the world economy going over a cliff. We need an effort like that now. And it frankly isn't just a $1 trillion package. It's probably a $2.5 trillion package, I'm informed. I have worked with Gordon Brown on outreach to get a very substantial letter with many former heads of government and state signing it that went to G20 leaders several weeks ago. And we are working on a follow-up with a clear agenda of what needs to be done. So I think it is a responsibility on the part of those countries in the global north to whom we normally look for solidarity with the south, and countries which have let the epidemics get away with then the spillover impacts for the global south, they're going to have to dig deep. Otherwise, we face not just a global recession over a couple of quarters, we face a depression. And it was very sobering to hear the executive director of the IMF say in the last 10 days or so that the worst forecasts that the IMF had made public were probably now too optimistic. So my experience at UNDP during global financial crisis, during Ebola, was there was far more global solidarity, and we're not seeing what we need yet.
Mm-hmm. Which is rather grim assessment of the situation today. And indeed, you mentioned that in a recent CNN interview, and also today, their estimates of the UN came out that probably 30 million people or more will be put into poverty in Africa alone because of COVID-19, and probably around the globe all added up will be a much, much larger number of people who are facing poverty, will be living in increased poor situations. But let's move on to a different topic.
Say a word about that. The head of the World Food Programme went to the UN Security Council a couple of weeks ago, and he said to the council that, in his opinion, we are facing a famine of biblical proportions. He said, of the 821 million people who we consider hungry in the world today, 135 million of those are on the brink of starvation. He said, our assessment is, with what's happening now, that we could add another 130 million to that. That takes you well over a quarter of a billion people on the brink of starvation. In terms of numbers being put back into extreme poverty, the estimates vary quite a lot. The World Bank is at the lower end of estimating about 49 million. The UN University has issued assessments, which many of the advocacy groups have also cottoned on to, saying it could be upwards of 480 million. Now, clearly, that's a very large range. But whatever the figure is, it would be the first time this century that the numbers have increased. And that's a very serious setback for the Sustainable Development Goals. So this is having a huge impact on the poorest and most marginalised, and countries which don't have the fiscal space of New Zealand or Germany or Belgium or, you know, a range of countries to deal with them.
Indeed. And this, the call for solidarity and collaboration, I think this call is very clear that you make here and have made in other places. Hopefully there will be, because this pandemic will last and the impact of the crisis will be obvious for quite some time, so that with time this knowledge of working together as a need to get us all together out of the crisis will sink through. But you mentioned the three countries, Belgium, New Zealand, Germany, which is a very good transition to the next question that I would have for you, because all three countries are led by women. And slowly, more and more voices are beginning to praise women politicians for their responses to the COVID-19 pandemic. And what's interesting to me is that in this praise, usually their empathy, courage and decisiveness is specifically mentioned. That's not mentioned when one talks about male leaders. The words empathy, decisiveness, or courage is not necessarily put in the context with the male leader. And I was wondering, why do you think that is?
So I have gone on the public record as saying that I believe that on average, the women leaders have done better than the men, which is not to say there aren't men who've done a fine job. I think, for example, of the president of the Republic of Korea, a very, very good and clear and strong response. I think what has characterized the successful responses of women leaders in Germany, in Norway, Finland, Denmark, Iceland, New Zealand, there's quite a list, is the style of leadership that they have. And it's a style that's often associated with women, but it's a style which, if adopted across genders, actually works rather well. It's a style that is consultative. It listens, it engages, it invites the public to go on a journey with you. What was realized by Jacinda Ardern in New Zealand was that we couldn't beat COVID-19 by simply making pronouncements. We had to take 5 million people with the journey, and if people didn't buy into it, you couldn't stop the spread of the disease. And so she is an example of a very, very good and clear communicator. I think the women have also by and large been prepared to take advice. There's no big egos here. And I think of Angela Merkel, what a powerful leader, but we don't think of Angela Merkel as someone with a swollen ego, and certainly not Jacinda Ardern. We think of them as people who are serious, they listen, they consult, they engage, they take advice, and they make decisions based on on judgment, which has proved to be quite good. So these are good characteristics for leadership of women and men. And I think, you know, as books are written about the great pandemic, I think that the women leaders will come out of this very much on the right side of history for doing their best to focus on human security, health and well-being, forgetting that if you bungle the public health response, the economic problems will be deeper and longer lasting. What you must have for a successful economy is a healthy population that feels secure. And certainly we feel secure in New Zealand because of the strategy that's been followed, which has been well communicated. Mm.
So, I mean, acknowledging this great leadership and the results that these leaders were able to achieve, as you described, does unfortunately not necessarily lead into concrete change, and would lead to more equal opportunities for women to get to leadership positions, or just to take up similar choices in life that men have as their display. So what would you say as the final question to you, what would need to be done to change the current leadership structures? It's a huge question, but maybe your kind of essence of thought on it.
So I'm reflecting on the very interesting survey work which Women Political Leaders has commissioned, and we've held a range of events about it, including in Reykjavik. We've produced the Reykjavik Index, looking at how women leaders are viewed. I think the widespread acknowledgement of how well a significant number of women leaders have done in this crisis may help us rewrite, the way forward, because it will be recognised that women stood up, were counted, and by and large did a good job. Positive role modelling counts for an enormous amount. You just can't dismiss these women as women of no consequence who can't do the job. Clearly, they've done an incredible job in very, very difficult circumstances. I think that the young women will look for this and say, yes. And actually, the responses I get as I talk to many people around the world is men and women, young and old alike, are saying, what's in the water in New Zealand? Didn't Angela Merkel handle this well? What about Ernest Solberg in Norway, who consulted children? Whoever consulted children about a major issue of state? She consulted children. So people are impressed. And I think for an organization like Women Political Leaders, we now have some very powerful advocacy tools for saying, this is what you get when you get women leaders. This is really something that has to be promoted. So I'm quite encouraged by it. I'm quite optimistic that it might just be, another turning the corner for encouraging more people to see the strengths that women bring to leadership.
Well, I think that would be a really positive takeaway for once. And I think on that optimistic outlook, we'll end our conversation here. And I'm thanking you for all your insights and sharing your experiences, and hopefully some of the advice that you give will be picked up very soon for the better for all of us. So thanks, Helen.